Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia titled Engendered by Translation, Love and Language in Modern Japanese Literature. Our speaker is Stanford University Professor Indra Levy. Introducing Professor Levy is Keith Vincent, Assistant Professor of Japanese and Comparative Literature at Boston University.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Indra Levy today, who teaches Japanese literature at Stanford University. Indra published in 2006 a really fantastic book called Sirens of the Western Shore, which deals with the figure of what she calls the Westernesque femme fatale in modern Japanese literature, mostly late 19th century texts. I think it's a really fantastic treatment of gender, of the role of translation in the formation of modern Japanese literature, and it also includes some of the most meticulous readings of Ukigumo and other really important modern texts that pays really important attention to the way the language works and the way that the extant translations that we have obscure what's really interesting about them. In the meantime, she's also done this new volume on translation in modern Japan that came out from Rutledge. And this is another really interesting collection of pieces that deal with this issue. I think Indra is one of a few scholars who are really taking this question of translation seriously and thinking about how to rethink Japanese modernity in general as a kind of translational modernity, and I recommend highly that you take a look at it. She told me this morning that her recent work is on humor and comedy and the translation of comedy in Japanese. So she was telling me an amazing story about the translation of a particular translation of Mark Twain into Kanbun Kuzushitai, into sort of cinefied, very stilted katai Japanese in, what was it, 1906 or so?
1903.
And anyway, that sounds like another really great project, and apparently the next chapter of that is on the early Soseki, who, as many of you know, is also a very comical writer. So anyway, I'm really excited that she's here to talk to us today. The title of her talk has changed slightly from what we had earlier, which it's now Engendered by Translation, Love and Language in Modern Japanese Literature. It's a great pleasure to welcome Indra Levy.
Well, let me begin by thanking Professor Vincent for that very nice introduction and for inviting me to participate in this this wonderful lecture series, which he informed me this morning has been going on at Boston University since the 1970s. I was really humbled to hear this and excited to, even more excited to be able to participate in this sort of long-running tradition. So today, I'll be speaking to you not only as someone who loves the challenge of translating from Japanese into English, but also as someone who is firmly convinced that we have a lot to gain from thinking about the role that translation plays in shaping our world as a whole. And I'm really pleased to be able to say this in a place where, you know, people have been thinking about translation for so long and so consistently. Of course, critical and scholarly interest in translation has been on the rise for the last two decades, you know, generally speaking. And yet, I think it still seems fair to say that translation gets a pretty bad rap. So you may be surprised to hear this. Let me explain what I mean. I don't think that anyone would object to the claim that language is fundamental. We use language every day. It allows us to have simple and complex thoughts, to communicate with other people, and to express feelings that are more complicated than I'm hungry, or I'm tired, or I'm miserable because my diaper is full. Without language, we would be reduced to crying like babies to express our most basic needs. So language is fundamental, and it is of primary importance to our lives, and I don't think that anyone would argue with this basic proposition, right? But what about translation? In terms of our gut feelings about it, I would venture to say that in comparison to language, translation seems somehow secondary. For instance, I can recall my undergraduate days when I was only able to read Japanese literature in translation. And almost invariably, it felt like I was reading through a thick veil that made the real language and experience of the text somehow obscure. If you were a practicing translator, chances are that it was precisely this feeling that motivated you to learn another language. It was certainly this feeling of frustration that made me want to learn Japanese, and even though I was studying at that time, as anyone in this room knows who is studying Japanese, it takes years and years and years. 2 or 3 years is not enough to get that feeling that you've passed through the veil. Well, strangely enough, in the very long process of studying Japanese language and literature, of trying to break through that veil, I ended up coming to a completely different understanding of translation. When I got beyond the veil of translation, what I discovered was that translation is just as fundamental to life as we know it as language itself. In other words, what I came to realize is that the veil of translation is truly ubiquitous, even though we often look right past it without taking notice of its presence or its effects. So this was an exciting revelation for me, and it is what I want to share with you today. Although translation has played a central role in shaping the culture of modern Japan, its importance is by no means limited to that particular case. Indeed, most of what we think we know about the world actually comes to us through translation. For instance, how many of us can claim to be able to read Plato, Dante, Cervantes, de Tocqueville, and Freud in the original? Surely, our understanding of these authors and their ideas owes a tremendous debt to the work of translators. So translations can shape the way that we think. They can shape what we think we know. They can even shape the way that we feel, or the way that we think we feel, or the way that we believe that we should feel. And it is at this point that I want to return to the specific case of modern Japanese literature. In the late 19th century, Japan was faced with the imminent threat of domination by Western powers. And the cultural response to this threat was to engage in a massive project of translating Western texts. Japanese translators at that time grappled with countless Western concepts for which there were no Japanese equivalents. And their prodigious efforts created new forms of knowledge in Japanese. But what's even more astonishing is that their work also spawned desires, feelings, and personality types that had not existed in Japan before. On top of all that, translations can also produce linguistic forms that did not exist before. I can hardly tell you how astonished I was to find out, after years of studying Japanese in the classroom and reading it on my own, that many elements of the language I had learned in the classroom as simply Japanese were in fact derived from translations of Western languages. That was an eye-opener, to be sure. Elements of the language that I had thought were Japanese, and peculiarly Japanese, some of them turned out to be, for example, things that were derived from translations of English. So even in this, my understanding of what was Japanese and what wasn't completely changed through this process. So in short, translations can be transformative. The two particular areas of transformation that I want to focus on today are gender on the one hand and language on the other. Ideas about gender and language have a tremendous influence on how we think about the world and how we perceive our place in it. And in modern Japan, both were deeply affected by the work of translation. So as I suggested at the outset, we all owe a tremendous debt to translators, and the profound changes that they wrought in modern Japan are particularly compelling examples of how their work can change the world. So that's the part of the story I want to tell today. And those of you who are practicing translators, I hope will find some inspiration here about the importance of the work that you do and the potential that you have as a translator. But that's only part of the story I want to tell. The other part has to do with the uncertainties and anxieties that can plague the translator's work. Is it really possible to bridge the gap between languages? Paradoxically, the more intimately a translator gets to know another language, the more he or she is likely to be haunted by this doubt. In addition to its transformative aspect, the anxiety of translation also played a critical role in the development of modern Japanese literature. The case in point that I will hone in on today is a modern Japanese novel about failed love, in which anxieties about translation, gender, and language are all thoroughly intertwined. The title of the novel is Drifting Clouds, or Ukigumo in Japanese, and the author is Futabate Shime. So here's the roadmap for the talk I'm going to give today. We will move through gender and language, and our final destination will be Drifting Clouds, which brings both of these topics together. So here we go. How can translation create new gender images, ideals, and ideologies? If a translation actively seeks to transform the values of the target culture, it can break the mold of gender conventions in the target culture and replace it with new ones. Now I'd like to give you a concrete example of how this works. So I've already mentioned that we're going to be looking at a story about failed love. Now I'd like to think about this word, love. Such a simple word, only four letters. Surely anyone can understand what this means, right? To us, it hardly seems like the kind of word that would pose a challenge to translators. But when we look into the matter of how this word was translated into Japanese in the late 19th century, we discover that it was not a simple matter at all. In fact, this is the very subject of a fascinating book by the Japanese cultural historian Saiki Junko, who you will see listed at the top of your handout. Her study places the relationships between men and women at the center of Japan's modernizing process and shows how the translation of the word love into Japanese in the late 19th century transformed the mental and emotional landscape of modern Japan. I find her work exciting for the way that it illuminates the relationship between translation and the development of modern categories of gender, which have had a profound impact on even the most personal aspects of life in Japan. So the title of her book, and you will see it on your handout once again, is A Comparative Cultural History of Iro and Ai. The Japanese words in the title, Iro and Ai, function as a kind of shorthand for two different sets of vocabulary and ideas about amorous relations that distinguish Japan's pre-modern and modern periods. Iro represents the Japanese understanding of gender relations prior to the influx of Western culture. Ai represents the new understanding introduced to modern Japan by way of translating the Western concept of love. Now, in English, there is no convenient equivalent for the Japanese term Iro, a point that Saiki goes to some length to discuss. So I have tentatively glossed the term in your handout as, in parentheses, as Eros. Amor is another option that came to mind, but neither of these really is quite right. The rich set of associations carried by this one little word in Japanese simply cannot be captured by a single word in English, even if we have to resort to Greek or French. We just don't have anything in the Western lexicon that I could find. So instead of trying to translate it, let me just describe it for you briefly. The word Iro was used for many centuries in Japan to indicate an intimate relationship, and this intimate relationship did not have to be between a man and a woman. It could also be between a man and a man. An intimate relationship that was motivated by a complex combination of spiritual, physical, sensual, and aesthetic drives. It was just as central to the practice of poetry as it was to the practice of prostitution. Now, the Japanese word ai is a bit easier to deal with in English because it was used in the modern period to translate the Western concept of love. In this sense, translating the word ai as love is a bit like reconstituting frozen orange juice. Just add water and you've got a really close facsimile of the real thing. And yet, there is still an important difference, as Saiki points out. In the context of Japanese Buddhism, the word ai originally had a negative connotation. Before it was used to translate the Western concept of love, ai meant something more like emotional attachment. According to Buddhist philosophy, emotional attachments are one of the major causes of human suffering and delusion, and hence one of the major impediments to achieving enlightenment. In modern-day Japan, however, thanks to the alchemical power of translation, ai has come to assume the same positive connotation that the word love has in English. And this is just one passing indication of the power of translation to effect major changes in the emotional landscape. Now let me briefly outline the most important parts of Saiki's argument for our purposes today. The first thing she points out is that many prominent Japanese writers of the late 19th century chose to represent the Western concept of love, either by transliterating it as dabu, to indicate its foreign derivation, or by translating it into the Japanese word ai. Now, as I mentioned before, the word ai originally had negative connotations in the Buddhist context. So why would Japanese writers choose to use this term instead of the other options? The word Iro had enjoyed widespread currency in both spoken and written discourse for many centuries, and it would have been the more obvious choice. But this word and its many synonyms were studiously avoided. Why? Well, the Japanese translators who advocated the concept of love, they wanted to establish a critical difference between the new foreign concept and the inherited Japanese vocabulary for describing amorous relations. What motivated them to make this distinction? In other words, what was it about the concept of love that struck them as so new that they had to come up with a new kind of translation for it? According to Syaki, the translation of love as I was particularly intended to emphasize a set of dichotomies that did not exist in the native term Iro, nor in the pre-modern Japanese worldview as a whole. Specifically, she cites the divide between inside and outside, interiority and exteriority, mind and body, and humans and animals. Most generally, and she amply documents this, late 19th century Japanese intellectuals deployed the term I to signify a purely spiritual and hence elevated union that was not motivated by physical desire. It was meant to represent love in a particularly Christian sense of the word. In addition to introducing a distinctly Christian worldview, these intellectuals also defined love as the province of civilized men and women, whereas lust, which they now associated with the Japanese term Iro, was considered barbaric and even beastly. According to their definition, the ideal relationship between a man and a woman should be based on mutual respect and mutual affinity of the sort that could only be developed when a man and woman got to know each other rather well. By contrast, relationships based on physical desire were the worst sort, being comparable to the behavior of birds and beasts. Now, between these two extremes of love and lust, there was the possibility of infatuation, which meant an attraction based on external qualities such as personal appearance or habits of dress. And this was considered kind of an intermediary step between barbarism and civilization. There's actually a term for this, half-civilized. Now, to sum up, love meant an attraction to a person's internal qualities. Infatuation and lust were considered inferior emotions because they were based on external qualities or physical impulses. Now, it really would be difficult to exaggerate the magnitude of this paradigm shift. For centuries in Japan, the word Iro had been used to describe amorous relations, and it had always included the meanings of physical beauty and sexual desire. There had never before been an attempt to isolate the feelings of mutual attraction from attraction to a person's external qualities or from impulses of a frankly sexual nature. In short, the dichotomy between love and lust simply had never existed in Japan prior to the introduction of this Western concept. So one goal of Saiki's study is to resuscitate the rich layers of meaning originally contained in the word Iro. And she does build a very compelling case for the value of thinking through the pre-modern Japanese sensibility and the culture of Iro on its own terms without imposing modern Western value judgments. Let me just give you a brief example. She points out that sex was considered sacred in the ancient Japanese worldview. According to native Japanese beliefs, a pair of male and female deities procreated the islands of Japan. And the story of their coupling, which includes a rather frank exchange about sexual intercourse between the two deities, stands at the very beginning of Japan's oldest extant book, a combination of myth and history called A Record of Ancient Matters. Essentially, the male deity says to the female deity something to the effect of, "I have a part of my body that protrudes, and you have a part of your body that recedes. How would it be if I were to put my part into yours?" To which the female deity simply responds, "That would be good." There's no embarrassment here. Clearly, the Japanese foundation myth poses a stark contrast to the Christian attitude towards sexual desire. Within such a worldview, the pursuit of sexual desire was neither denigrated nor discouraged. Rather, it was considered as something that could lead to spiritual elevation, albeit of a kind that bears no resemblance to spirituality in the Christian sense of the word. Another issue that Saiki raises is the practical difficulties faced by Japan's first advocates of Western-style love. While members of the educated elite were able to learn about the distant cultures of the West, they lived in a society that generally adhered to the traditional Confucian rule of segregating the sexes beyond the age of 7. As a result, those who wanted to put the ideal of love into practice confronted a rather crucial logistical problem. Just where were they going to meet a member of the opposite sex, get to know them well enough so that they could actually fall in love or fulfill the definition of love as it had been put out? There was a yawning gap between social reality and the translated ideal. Ironically, one of the only places where men and women could get to know each other well enough that they might fall in love was the pleasure quarters. those areas in Japanese cities that were officially sanctioned to traffic in a wide variety of female entertainers, including those who would sell their sex, would sell sex for money. For centuries, the pleasure quarters had served as the main venues for the pursuit of iro. As Saiki points out, one of the early proponents of the new ideal of love, a writer by the name of Tsubochi Shoyo, actually married a prostitute whom he had met in the pleasure quarters, a place that should have been strictly off-limits to anyone who thought of iro as barbarous or beastly. And even when Shoyo wrote his first work of fiction about love, he could not come up with an alternative to the geisha heroine, which immediately set off a train of associations to the traditional world of iro. Today, the word ai has become fairly commonplace in Japanese, and most people are probably not aware that its current meaning only goes back to the late 19th century. Moreover, most Japanese are no more likely than the average American to understand the original connotations of the word iro. So at this point, we can make a few general observations about the effects of translation on gender in modern Japan. On the one hand, the translation of the word love as ai created a new, completely new paradigm for intimate relations between the sexes. On the part of the translators, there was a clear intent to transform the mental and emotional landscape of the target culture. And at least insofar as there was a major shift in consciousness, their translation succeeded in achieving its goal. On the other hand, the gap between the translated ideal and social reality posed a problem, especially for the early proponents of love, both in their lives and in their literary expressions. While they held up the ideal of a perfect union, not only between man and woman, but also between Japanese society and their perception of the Western model, these writers were constantly faced with the distinct possibility that such a union was impossible to achieve. Now, this desire for a perfect union is actually where the new gender ideal produced by translation dovetails with the new language ideal that resulted from Japan's encounter with the West. From the Japanese perspective, there was something very distinctive and surprising about Western writing, whether it came from the Netherlands, England, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Russia, or have you. What was so surprising, and how can we lump all these different languages together to make one generalizing statement? Well, no matter where the writing came from, what was surprising about it to the Japanese was that it was written in, it was writing that was in the vernacular language, the language that was the spoken language of the country. Needless to say, vernacular literature has a long and rather illustrious history in Europe, featuring celebrated names like Dante and Chaucer. But in Japan, the spoken parlance of daily life was never considered to be appropriate for use in writing, whether literary or otherwise. So the discovery of Western vernacular writing prompted a sea change in Japanese perceptions of language, both written and spoken. Specifically, it led to a language reform movement that sought to unify Japanese speech and writing. So prior to the creation of the modern Japanese vernacular style, this requires a little bit of history to understand what happens, there were two basic categories of writing in Japan. One was writing in the classical Japanese style. Now, this style traced its lineage all the way back to the golden age of Japanese court culture, which came to a close in the early 12th century. Another option for writing was writing in Chinese. The tradition of writing in Chinese actually goes even farther back. Prior to the introduction of Chinese characters in the 5th century, there was no writing system in Japan at all. So essentially, from that time until the 19th century, when Japan shifted to shifted its view to looking towards the West for its major model of learning, Chinese writing constituted the lingua franca of high learning and intellectual discourse. Its role and importance in Japan was essentially equivalent to the role of Latin in medieval Europe. So this was the basic lay of the land when Japanese intellectuals discovered that vernacular writing was the standard practice in the West. Many of them began to call for the reform of Japanese writing in accordance with the new Western model. The rationale sounded good. It was that writing in the language of everyday speech would be much better suited for the dissemination of masses of information to large national readership. Classical Chinese was difficult to learn, and the classical Japanese style followed poetic and aesthetic conventions that were not conducive to straightforward communication. So by the late 1880s, some novelists had also joined to this call for reform. What they proposed was the development of a new literary style that would unify speech and writing, which they saw as one of the key features of modern Western literature. So here we, again, we have this kind of this desire for a perfect union. Now, Bear's emphasizing that the call to use spoken language for written discourse in the case of Japan was not so much based on a new appreciation of the unique qualities of spoken Japanese, but rather on the discovery of a new form of writing that hailed from the West. So in other words, the desire to unify Japanese speech and writing was driven by the desire to unify Japanese writing with Western writing. So we have two different vectors of desire here, one pointing toward the familiar domain of Japanese speech, and the other one pointing to the exotic realm of Western letters. And in actual practice, the result was the creation of a Japanese vernacular style that was infused with exotic linguistic elements from Western writing. Now, this is a little bit difficult to explain in English, essentially because the things that were exotic in the Japanese context, for example, if it was something that came from English, when we translate it back into English, well, it's just not exotic anymore. It completely fits right into the landscape. But I do happen to have one particularly rich example for you that works even in translation into English. One of the earliest practitioners of vernacular fiction in Japan was a novelist by the name of Yamada Bimyo. While Bimyo strenuously defended the potential of spoken Japanese to rival the beauty of the classical style, in practice, he employed rhetorical strategies that profoundly conveyed his fashionable knowledge of English literature. These elements bore no discernible relationship to the habits of Japanese speech, none whatsoever. And here's one of my favorite examples. I like to always offer this disclaimer. I've made every attempt to follow the original as closely as possible here. Whatever defects mar the translation, however, are the sole responsibility of Yamada Bimyo himself. All right, and I quote, "On the coast stands a stately castle, and the light of the sun glares at the very profile of the castle so that the Caucasian color of its white wall this morning is a pale American Indian color, and also the dazzled eyeballs of its windows are sparkling," unquote. Yeah, that's it. This peculiar descriptive language sounds just as forced in English as it does in Japanese. I very much doubt that anyone else in either language has ever used words like Caucasian and American Indian to describe the color of a wall. And the comparison of windows to eyeballs also sits uncomfortably in both languages. But it was precisely these kinds of exotic novelties that led Bimyo to enjoy a short-lived but widespread popularity in Japan in the late 1880s. Now, Bimyo's vernacular style was peppered with exotic linguistic novelties, but it did not set a lasting precedent for future writers. It was his contemporary and rival, a man by the name of Futabate Shime, who is known today as the progenitor of the vernacular literary style that later became the sanpanan of modern Japanese fiction. Now, let's talk about Futabate. His first love was the Russian novel, which he studied with a brilliant teacher at a foreign language school. For every class, his teacher would read works of Russian fiction aloud in a highly engaging manner, almost seeming to act them out, and the stories would just come alive. Apparently, Futabate was completely enthralled. When he set his sights on writing fiction in vernacular Japanese, it was his hope to recreate the kind of literature he had experienced through the novels of Gogol, Turgenev, and Dostoevsky. He took a two-pronged approach to fulfilling this ambition. On the one hand, he translated Russian novels into Japanese, and on the other hand, he also wrote a novel of his own. So his novel, Drifting Clouds, brings the dual themes of love and language together in a way that I find absolutely fascinating. The basic story of Drifting Clouds is fairly simple. A hapless young man loses his job, then he loses the woman he wanted to marry. You've all heard this story before, I'm sure. You probably see the movies come out three or four times a year from Hollywood. There's nothing particularly new about this. It may have been new at the time that he wrote it in the context of Japan, but it's not new to us, and I have to say, it's not, you know, the story itself not particularly interesting. But the way that this story is written gives rise to a meta-narrative on love and language that is both surprising and profound. In order to appreciate its full significance, we first need to consider some basic aspects of Futabate's engagement with literature. Toward that end, it would be difficult to exaggerate the importance of his work as a translator. He was the first to translate a Western vernacular text into a form of vernacular Japanese. In his day, literary translators were content to rework the exotic content of Western stories into the classical styles I mentioned earlier. But Futabate set out single-handedly to reproduce in Japanese what he saw as the very essence of the Russian novel, the fact that it was written in the vernacular. Unlike his contemporaries, he even followed such a stringent personal standard for faithful translation that he tried to reproduce the exact same number of words, commas, and periods as the original text. He really wanted to achieve a perfect union, right? And this is also something that if you've practiced translation, you know is practically impossible to achieve. So what drove him to these kind of extremes at a time when there was no demand for such acts of faith in the Japanese literary world? Well, his motivation came from his understanding of the modern novel itself. In an essay he wrote in 1886, he stated that the purpose of the novel is to reveal an essential truth hidden within the external trappings of reality, and that this could only be achieved through writing that was what he called alive. His theory suggested tremendous reverence for Russian novels and the ability of their vernacular language to reveal truth. Indeed, Futabate was one of the first Japanese intellectuals to treat the vernacular novel with the respect customarily reserved for the Chinese classics. Or to put it another way, he was the first one in Japan to accord the vernacular novel with the respect normally accorded to the language of truth. And it was this passionate belief that led him to write his own novel in the vernacular. So now that we've covered the key background elements of Futabate's literary practice, let's jump into the story of Drifting Clouds. As I mentioned before, it's a pretty basic plot, but let me complete the outlines, and you'll see the names of the main four characters written on your handout to help you keep track. The protagonist, named Bunzo, falls in love with his cousin, Osei. Osei's mother, Omasa, has hinted that she would support their marriage, but when Bunzo loses his job, everyone begins to turn against him. Omasa becomes increasingly hostile towards Bunzo and increasingly friendly towards his former colleague, Noboru. Now, Nomura is not only his former colleague, but he's much more successful and moves up the ranks of the government bureaucracy fairly quickly. In turn, Osei also seemed to shift her affections from Bunzo to Noboru. Well, things go from bad to worse, and by the end of the novel, Bunzo is reduced to a complete state of alienation from everyone around him. Okay, let me tell you a little bit more about the important characters and the distinctions between them. Osei is described as a natural-born mimic, a young woman with a distinct facility for picking up on new trends and an equal tendency to discard them as soon as something newer and more interesting comes along. Bunzo, by contrast, is characterized by an absolute adherence to his own ideals, which makes him almost completely incapable of adapting to his surroundings. Within the terms of Futabate's novel, Osei is a talker, while Bunzo is a thinker, or more precisely, someone who sees everything in terms of written texts. What I want to propose is that the story of the ever-widening gap between these two characters can be read as a story about the failed betrothal of speech and writing, which is quite an irony for a vernacular novel that claimed to bring the two together. Now, all four of the main characters in Drifting Clouds are actually defined by their use of language. Bunzo is completely inept when it comes to manipulating spoken language. He doesn't know how to curry favor with his boss, which leads to his loss of unemployment. His loss of employment. He can't find the right words to mollify his angry aunt. She's angry at the fact that he lost his job. He's frequently reduced to stuttering in moments of highly charged emotion. And most importantly, he can't find a way to beat out his rival, Noboru, in securing the affections of Osei. Noboru is a much better speaker than he is. And all the other characters in this novel are much better speakers than Bunzo. We already know that Osei is a natural-born mimic. Her mother, Omasa, we are told, spins out words, and I quote, with a will that could turn even a heron into a crow, unquote. And Noboru's rise up the bureaucratic ladder is fueled by what we are told is an inexhaustible wealth of eloquence when it comes to flattering the boss. Now, the sharp division between Bunzo and these strategic talkers neatly coincides with class distinctions as well. And just to, if you don't know anything about Japanese history, I should briefly explain. In Japan, prior to the modern period, for 300 years, there was a very strict social hierarchy system of four official classes. The samurai class was at the top. The merchant class was at the bottom, and in between we have farmers and artisans. The only two classes that play an important role in ukikumori, the top and the bottom, the samurai and the merchant class. The merchant class was at the bottom of this hierarchy because they didn't produce anything. So this was a moral hierarchy. They were at the bottom of the social hierarchy, but they had a tremendous amount of power because they, of course, had... they had the economic riches, right? The samurai claimed moral superiority, and it was considered beneath their contempt to deal with money. So this is the kind of tension that we find at play in ukigumo, and in it's also then tied into the use of language, as I'm about to show you. So both Omasa and Noboru claim samurai roots, but the narrator immediately casts suspicion on their lineage. And as a successful money lender, Omasa is particularly associated with the merchant class. By contrast, Bunzo's bona fide samurai lineage is explained in some detail. His father was a former retainer for the governing clan that was toppled by the Meiji Restoration of 1868. After that, he's stripped of his social class and formal stripped of his social standing and formal occupation, and he finds himself completely unable to navigate the new world. Interestingly, his dilemma. His inability to navigate in this new world is partly it's partly caused by the distinction between spoken and written language. And if you look, I have this quote written down there. This is what the narrator tells us about him. Quote, his mouth weighted down by sayo shikaraba could not suddenly make the sound, hey. Okay. Sayo shikaraba in Japanese is shorthand for the punctilious language of the samurai class. In tone, it stands somewhere between such being the case, therefore, and ergo sum. It's a sinified phrase that's emblematic of a spoken language that imitated writing. And it was it imitated the kind of writing that was the basic foundation from which the samurai class claimed moral and intellectual authority. Firmly anchored to the bedrock of written language, Bunzo's father cannot manipulate spoken language of commercial negotiations that are captured in the word hey. A hey is something like yes, sir, or yes'm in English. From the perspective of his class, hey is an obsequious merchant expression, a contemptible and deceptive performance of servility undertaken in the interest of personal profit. Yet in a world no longer defined by a stable social hierarchy, Bunzo's father's inability to treat spoken language as the malleable stuff of verbal performance renders what was once a prized social identity into a deadly economic albatross. To put it in another way, he can't accept the flexibility of words in performative context, or the fact that they can do as well as mean things. Now, Bunzo inherits his father's attitude towards language. In fact, his father places such a complete emphasis on education that Bunzo's subjection to the written word becomes his most significant patrimony. While Omasa and Noboru personify the colloquial as the dominant language of social commerce, Bunzo presents a subjectivity formed by Chinese and Western writing, which were, of course, the languages of conceptual commerce, or the trade in ideas. The fundamental incompatibility between the malleable spoken parlance of social commerce and inflexible letter-bound language of ideas serves as a primary source of conflict in Drifting Clouds. Indeed, this novel is distinguished by the fact that almost all of its events are verbal exchanges. And Bunzo is almost always on the losing side. Time and time again, we find him overwhelmed by the artful words of others. His alienation from their language initiates an internal soliloquy by which he attempts to comprehend the world around him. Drifting Clouds thus dramatizes a power struggle between two different approaches to language. The fluid speech of Omasa and Noboru, which can suddenly change direction from one day to the next depending on the context, versus the rigid, letter-bound consciousness of Bunzo, which fully expects to find a stable, unchanging meaning in everything and everyone. The love interest, Osei, is the enigmatic hybrid at the center of the struggle. Not only is she presumably of mixed class, as the daughter of Omasa and Bunzo's paternal uncle, But her penchant for mimicry assimilates the written diction of Chinese and English into her everyday speech. Indeed, it is the way she uses these languages that causes Bunzhou to fall in love with her. Osei repeats Bunzhou's own favorite words in a way that confirms his sense of self and lures him into thinking that she and he are alike in mind and spirit. For instance, while Bunzhou was tutoring Osei in English, he also talked to her about various topics of interest to the young intellectuals of his day, such as the state of Japanese women, the relative merits of social intercourse between men and women, and even hygiene. Yes, these were the hot topics of the day. Now, one day he asks her why she is not wearing her spectacles or scarf as usual, and she replies, "But aren't you the one who said that they are actually harmful to people in good health?" Bunzhou is so pleased to hear Osei repeat his lesson that he breaks into a rare smile. It never occurs to him that she's just doing what she does best, mimicry. Now, the degree to which his idolization of Osei hinges upon her use of language becomes comically clear in the following passage, and you will find this passage on number 2 on your handout. Bunzhou and Osei are home alone together, and their conversation quickly turns to their relationship. When Osei innocently declares that Bunzhou is her newfound confidant, and in Japanese she uses the word shinyu, which was also not one of these words often used in casual conversation, he responds with a faltering attempt to confess his true feelings. And I quote, "But I am utterly incapable of associating with you as confidant." Now, what is that supposed to mean? Just why can't you associate with me as a confidant? Why? Because I don't understand you, and you also don't understand me, so associating as a confidant is, well, is that it? But I believe that I understand you very well. You are learned, your conduct is exemplary, you treat your parents with filial piety. That's why I say that you don't understand me. You say that I treat my parents with filial piety, but I am not a good son. For me, there is something more important than parents, stammered Bunzhou, hanging his head. Osei stared at Bunzhou with a puzzled look. Something more important than parents. Oh, there is also something more important to me than parents. Bunzhou raised his hung head. What? You too have that? Yes, I do. Who is it? It's not a person. It's truth. Truth, repeated Bunzhou with a tremble, biting his lips in a moment of silence, soon after which he let out suddenly with a stunned sigh, "Ah, you are a chaste one, a pure one. What is more important than parents is truth. Ah, you are a pure one." Unquote. All right. Osei's demonstration of fluency in Bunzhou's learned language generates the comedy of their exchange. Her grasp of Bunzhou's idiom has been based on their English lessons and discussions of abstract social and ethical questions. When Bunzhou suddenly blurts out that he is not a good son because he values something more than his parents, Osei recasts his faltering confession, into the form of a test question, and then searches for a clever answer. What could be more important than parents or filial piety? Aha! It must be the new Western ideal of truth. This word truth was a key component of many of the new systems of thought coming into Japan from the West, such as Christianity, philosophy, and science, and it had a set Japanese translation, which you will also find on your handout. The set translation was shinri. It's written in Chinese characters, and those characters carry the weight of written language in a way that brings it much closer to the Latin veritas. Truth can have this tremendous weight in English as well, but we also use it in all sorts of casual ways. So I'm just trying to make this distinction here for you. When someone says shinri in Japanese, it's different from when we say, "Oh, is that true?" Right? In Japanese, that would be a different expression. Ah, honto. So when she says shinri, it's much closer to saying, the thing that's most important to me is veritas. It's certainly not a term that would be used in casual conversation, and she never elaborates on what she means by it. In fact, the question of meaning has nothing to do with her use of the word here. It's simply a clever way to keep up her end of a conversation that strikes her, apparently, as highly intellectual. Her enunciation of an absolute value in modern Western thought thus reduces the term to the status of an exotic verbal prop. And yet, Bunzo interprets her use of the word here as a sure sign of her spiritual purity. This scene reveals a constitutive difference between Osei and Bunzo. Osei is not subject to the written word. Rather, she manipulates that language to aggrandize her self-image. Her meaningless enunciation of the word truth has the virtually alchemical effect of converting the heavy materiality of the written sign into the weightless ephemerality of sound. While her language is quintessentially performative, however, Bunzo reads it in the referential mode. To our thoroughly literal-minded protagonist, the word truth is strictly bound to the textual sources that give it meaning. Thus, when she spouts out this word in place of the beloved's name he is expecting to hear, he sees a direct reflection of the speaker's pristine self, instead of his own image inadvertently parodied in her performance. The ideology of love, or I, also plays a special role in shaping Bunzo's view of Osei. Recalling the definition of love propagated by Futabate's contemporaries, we find that Bunzo has adhered pretty closely to the prescription. Although it, of course, doesn't hurt that Osei is beautiful, Bunzo's attraction to her is not based on looks, but rather on what he thinks he knows about her mind and spirit. Let me briefly quote part of an internal monologue that outlines Bunzo's own conception of love. As a rule, he's saying this to himself, as a rule, two mutually loving hearts, each being part of one whole, do not act separately from each other, nor could they, even if they tried. Thus, when one heart is happy, the other heart shares in the happiness. When one heart is sad, the other heart shares in the sadness. When one heart is having fun, the other heart shares in the fun. And he goes on like this for quite some time, but I think you get the picture. The very ideology of love as total communion, this is what actually stokes the fear of deception and betrayal, because Bunzo's expectation of absolute sameness from the beloved is tantamount to demanding that his beloved pretty much perform a precise imitation of himself. So Osei's innate talent for mimicry makes her the perfect object for Bunzo's affections and also makes her the most likely to betray him. Thank you. As Osei drifts further and further from Noboru, Bunzo becomes increasingly consumed by doubts about the woman he had idolized. He expends so much time and energy trying to determine the real meaning of her words and actions that he descends into a state of nervous prostration towards the end of the novel. And this is the final long quote that I'm going to give you today. Incessant thinking about the same thing eventually exhausts the human mind, weakening its powers of discernment. Thus, while Bunzo was constantly worrying about Osei, at some point his concentration scattered and was unable to focus on a single thing, and at times he would have haphazard thoughts about fragments that were totally unrelated to each other. Once he was lying down with his head cupped in his hands, staring at the ceiling, at first thinking this and that about Osei as usual, when he happened to notice the grain of the wood ceiling, and he suddenly had a strange thought. Looking at it this way, it looks like marks left by flowing water. Once this thought occurred to him, he completely forgot about Osei, and continuing to stare even harder at the ceiling, he thought, depending on one's state of mind, it can even appear to have peaks and valleys. So that's an optikaru iryuzon. And in the Japanese text, this is put in katakana so that we know it's a foreign word. Optical illusion. Suddenly, recalling the magnificently bearded face of the foreign lecturer who taught Bunzo and the others physics, he simultaneously forgot about the grain of the ceiling. Next, he saw seven or eight students appear before his very eyes, all of whom were his classmates, some with pencils stuck behind their ears, some carrying books, and still others opening the books to read. Upon looking closer, it seemed that Bunzo himself was among them. Now, the lecture on electricity, another foreign word, had ended and an exam was to take place, and everyone was gathered around an electrical machine. And just as it seemed that they were all arguing about something he could not make out, suddenly, the machine and the students vanished without a trace like so much smoke, and the wood grain came back into sight. Saying, so that's an optikaru iryuzon. Bunzo smiled for no reason. Speaking of illusion, the most interesting book I've ever read is Sully's Illusions. I must have finished reading it in 2 days and a night. How does a person get so smart? He must have an intricately organized brain. Though there would seem to be no relation between Sully's brain and Osei, at this moment, the thought of Osei suddenly pierced his chest, erupting like a gushing water fountain. End quote. That in the midst of his obsession with Osei, Bunzo suddenly recalls the word illusion is surely not an entirely haphazard thought. As this stream of association indicates, the word illusion exists in Bunzo's mind as part of the Western lexicon of scientific truth that he studied in school. If the deeply reverberating sound of truth that was Osei's siren song, this sudden musing on illusions constitutes Bunzo's unsung refrain. In the linguistic battle pitched by Bunzo, Omasa, and Noboru, Osei personifies the bewitching appeal of a language that can alchemically compound even the most intractable of differences under the single sign of truth. In this sense, she's both Futabate's dream and his nightmare. She spans the gap between writing and speech, between foreign languages and Japanese, with no apparent effort. This was precisely his goal as a vernacular writer. As both translator and novelist, he attempted to create a language that would span all of these gaps. Yet given his profound reverence for the Russian novel as a textually fixed language of truth, he must have also harbored a deep-seated anxiety about the elusive medium of spoken Japanese. Indeed, he must have been haunted by the possibility that writing in the Japanese vernacular would have the same effect as Osei's pronouncement of truth, a hollow ring that reduces the truth of the modern novel to the status of mere talk. Drifting Clouds powerfully evokes the unsettling proximity between truth and illusion that inhabits the space between languages, not only the ineffable difference and sameness of veritas, truth, and shindi, but also the confounding difference between writing and speech, truth as a written sign and truth in quotes. And in this sense, I think that Drifting Cloud speaks to one of the most persistent anxieties of translation, the fear of having placed undue faith in the ability of one language to reflect another. And for the translator who truly loves language, the ideal of a perfect union is no less elusive than was the pursuit of love itself in late 19th century Japan. And with that, I thank you very much for listening. Thanks.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Stanford University Professor Indra Levy. Professor Levy's lecture was titled Engendered by Translation, Love and Language in Modern Japanese Literature, and was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Asia. Introducing tonight's speaker was Keith Vincent, Assistant Professor of Japanese and Comparative Literature at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mark Liam Bruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.